I'll let him tell you how long, and I'll also ask him. Our speaker is the only one that posts his time tonight, and I would ask him to do that. Our speaker tonight is Chaser. He's been around the rooms. He's quite involved in service work. He's involved in helping others to a great extent, and I know he has a great message of recovery for us. Dan, come on up here and take the mic and tell us how it's done.
Thank you so much, Lynn, and good evening, everybody. I am Dan, and I am a nicotine addict, and I am very, very grateful to be here tonight. And, wow. I tried to convince Lynn to just play last year's tape and be done with it, but she wouldn't go for it for some strange reason. Oh, well. I guess I gotta talk. Anyway, I started smoking when I was about, first off, I was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1960, and I grew up in New England, and several towns in New England, Connecticut, Maine, and Massachusetts. And started smoking when I was about the age of 12, but even before that, you know, I don't know if some of you remember this, but do you remember when the airlines used to give you those miniature packs of cigarettes? My dad used to do a lot of flying for his job. He worked for the Navy, and my dad used to bring home these miniature packs of cigarettes, those complimentary packs that they have on the airlines, that the airlines give you. And he didn't smoke. My mom didn't smoke. So he just threw them on the table, and he'd give them to one of his smoking buddies or throw them away if they didn't get given away. Well, at about the age of, I can even remember at about the age of eight or nine years old, being very intrigued by these little sticks that came in these miniature packs, you know. And once in a while we would steal them, and my brothers and I would steal a pack of those cigarettes, and nobody was home, we'd light up. And at that age, of course, I didn't inhale. I didn't even know what how to smoke. I just lit the thing and put it in my hand and put it to my mouth. And that, you know, we were cool. We were doing what the grown-ups did, you know. And it just seemed like a lot of fun at the time. But at about the age of 12, when I was living in Connecticut, I started getting into a lot of trouble at home. Just malicious stuff, vandalism, and there was one underage drinking escapade or episode. And I started getting into enough trouble that the judge said summer camp or juvenile detention. So they packed me off to summer camp. And that is where I actually started my smoking career. We were on a camp, overnight camp out. And one of the counselor's assistants brought in a carton of cigarettes, and he just started handing them out to the kids who wanted them. And I took a pack, and I took one of those cigarettes out of the pack, and I lit up, and I took a deep inhale. And I was very surprised. I didn't cough. I didn't retch. I didn't get sick. And the only thing I knew is that I wanted another one, so I smoked another one. And I had my own little pack all to myself, and boy, was I proud. I had just inhaled my first cigarette. I remember that so distinctly that how cool it was. It was like I didn't realize it at the time, but it was like a rite of passage, I guess. So that's where I started to smoke. Well, summer camp came to an end. And I started to settle down a little bit. I hung out with my older brothers at their friend's house, at the neighbor's. And that's where I did most of my smoking, behind my mom and dad's back, you know. And that's where I was started to get introduced again to alcohol, more alcohol, and marijuana. And even at that young age, I remember I used to think marijuana and cocaine and you know, what they taught us in school back then was marijuana, cocaine, heroin. It was all the same, lumped together, you know. You might as well just be doing one or the other, and it's bad for you. I'm not condoning the use of marijuana, mind you. But I do remember coming home stoned and coming home drunk several times, sneaking past my mom and dad, going up to bed, getting sick. And I did that for about a year, and about 1974 came along. And my father got a transfer to Naples, Italy. And when we got to Naples, he was supposed to stay there a year. We ended up staying two. And I was in heaven. I found out that the drinking age was, I believe it was 21. The drinking age was never enforced or rarely enforced. Buying cigarettes was a breeze. I could get them on the base for 10 cents a pack or a dollar a carton. I'd sneak them home. I'd sneak a little booze home now and then. And I just continued my partying life for the next 2 years. And cigarettes were a very integral part of that 2 years. I remember there were having dry spells, and when I couldn't get to the base or when I couldn't get to the liquor store, and how jittery and how nasty I felt, and I couldn't account for it. I just didn't know what was going on with my body, and I slowly started to realize that it was the nicotine and the booze that you know, it was such a feel-good thing that I wanted more and more and more. And I hooked up with a local band as a drummer. There was a lot of partying going on in the band as we traveled. And of course, I was still in school. My grades were in the tank. But those 2 years went by, and I came home. And we got back to Connecticut. And I remember very distinctly trying to, as the plane was, the wheels were touching the ground, the wheels of the plane were touching the ground in New York, I was scheming, trying to figure out how am I going to get my alcohol and my nicotine. And fortunately, they had cigarette machines back then. And I could walk into any gas station and get cigarettes. And if anybody questioned me, I'd just say they were for my older brother, and that was the end of it. And alcohol was a little bit harder to do. Fortunately, though, and my dad was not an alcoholic by any means, I would like to say this, but he did entertain a lot in his line of work, and he kept a very full liquor cabinet. And that's pretty much where I got my booze. I'd skim a little off the bottle and put some water in, or go over to my... Again, I still had my brother's friend's house to go to, and I'd wax one of their cars for a pack of cigarettes or a Bacardi and Coke, or wash and wax their car for a little bit of marijuana or something. So I was back in the groove, you know. And back in school, my grades started to get a little bit better. I started to knuckle down. And two more years went by, and it was graduation day. We had a hell of a blowout. Everything was there, the alcohol, the nicotine, and the marijuana, and got to play, do a set with the band. And it was either time to go into the workforce or go to college. Now, I'm not trying to boast or be boastful or anything like that, but my dad, working for the Navy as an electrical engineer, made a pretty damn good salary. And I had it. I could have had it all. He was going to stake me for college, room and board, living expenses, the whole nine yards, traveling, you name it. But I chose to go into the workforce directly as an electrician, working at a defense plant building, working on submarines. I wanted a year off or so just to collect my thoughts. Or at least that was my excuse. And what I really wanted to do was party. And I just wanted a paycheck to feed my partying habits, you know. So a few years went by, and my dad says, when are you going to college? And, you know, I had it all. I could have, with my grades the way they were, gone to a pretty decent school, all expenses paid, and in retrospect, I turned it all down. Just so I could party, smoke, drink, and get stoned. And a couple of years went by, and needless to say, my dad was quite disappointed in me. And continued to smoke, continued to drink, get stoned. And my smoking, as I could see, was very much out of control. I used to burn holes in my clothes, in my car seat, in my furniture. Was still living at home, mind you. We had a large ranch in Connecticut, and my dad needed the help, so he kept us, and he let us stay at the house. And, wow. A few years went by, and my mom and dad got separated. And my mom said that she wanted to come out to Arizona on a trail ride. And 6 days on horseback in the Superstition Wilderness, that was her lifelong dream before she died, she said. She was diabetic, but she wasn't ill or anything. She just said before she leaves this earth, that is something that she wanted to do. So off we went to Arizona, and we spent almost a month there. And my first instinct was, well, are we going to be able to smoke on this ride? Am I going to be able to smoke? When can I smoke? Where can I smoke? What can I, where am I going to keep my extra cigarettes, extra booze, a little bit of reefer, you know? Wow. And it went pretty well. It went very well, as a matter of fact. I was more consumed with how my mom was enjoying the ride, I found out, because I just wanted her to have a good time. This was her lifelong dream. And we got back from Arizona, and my mom decided, since the separation, that she wanted to move back to Arizona. So she did, and she was in kind of a frail state at the time due to her diabetes and some other health-related problems. And I said, well, Mom, I'll just come out there with you and help you get settled. And when you get settled, I'll come back home. Needless to say, my drinking, smoking, and drugging was spiraling and spiraling and spiraling. And I continued to stay out here in Arizona. Got my own place for a little while, but Mom needed the help here, so I eventually moved back in here. Here to the house, and she put up with my drinking and my smoking, and I remember it was then I was introduced to another 12-step program that because of my drinking was becoming such a problem. My boss said, you know, it's either my way or the highway. Go get some help. So that was my introduction to AA. And I stayed sober. This was, by now, was 1987, and I believe it was 1987. Anyway, that was my introduction to AA, and I got sober for about 11 months. And then I slowly stopped going to meetings and stopped going to meetings more and more. And that following Christmas, I said, well, I think I'm cured. I can handle it. And I took my first drink for the first time in 11 months. And I had a pretty good time, and I felt good, and I drank in moderation, or at least so I thought. And I thought I smoked in moderation. I thought I was doing pretty good. But that was my introduction to the 12 steps. And since I had started doing those steps in the other program, the seed had been planted. And I'm going to fast forward a few years to about 1990 or so. And the cigarettes were getting more and more expensive. Oh, hell, I remember saying I was going to quit smoking when cigarettes hit $1 a pack. And then $2 a pack, and $3, and $4, and $5, and so on. They're about $6 a pack here in Arizona right now. And I continued to buy them for a long time. I used to get them by the carton. I always thought it was cheaper, and I used to always have... I never ran out. And well, let's see. Where am I? Hang on a second. I am going to mute the mic and take a drink of water. All right, back. Thank you very much for waiting. I got my first DUI in 1992, back to AA, as per the orders of the judge. My biggest concern was that when I spent my 24 hours in jail was, am I going to be able to smoke in there, in the jail? No. So I went 24 hours without a cigarette. And again, it was back into, after I got out of jail, it was back to AA and back to the 12 steps. And I half-heartedly worked the steps and went to meetings and was a good boy for a little while. And coming up to 1997 was the year that my mom passed away. And I had since bought the house. And she was gone. And my drinking again, and my smoking, and my drugging spiraled totally out of control. Because of my mom, I think I was just trying to fill a huge void in the... trying to fill a huge void, sorry, that, well, I'll just leave it there. I was just trying to fill a huge void. Anyway, I was smoking now about 2.5-3 packs a day, and it still controlled my life. I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, I was still in the workforce. I was still actively working, and I think about the lost time now in retrospect, the lost time wasted on cigarette breaks, and the lost time, the money that I've wasted burning holes in my clothes and burning holes in the furniture and anyway, I came back to Connecticut for a little while just to visit. Came back to Arizona, got settled in, and in 1998, I bought my first computer. That was my introduction to the internet. And just a few months into being on the internet, I met this nice lady Very nice lady. And we talked about a lot of different things. And one of the things I remember talking about was after we had gotten to know each other for a long while, she asked me if I had any deep, dark secrets that I wanted to divulge. You know, those kind of secrets that you have. You an axe murderer? Are you a... so on and so forth. And I said, well, yeah, I am an out-of-control alcoholic. I don't know what motivated me to tell her. I think she was probably the first person that I had trusted in a very, very long time. That's probably it. And she said, well, if you want my phone number, you have to be sober. So, don't get me wrong, I didn't do this just for Cheryl, I did this for myself, because I knew I wasn't going to last if I kept going the way I was. But, again, it was back to AA. And, continued to smoke, quit a few times half-heartedly. I had quit a lot. I probably quit about 100 times over the last 30 years. And tried every single method that you possibly could find, short of being poofed by a mad Russian. I never tried that one, Paula, honest. Anyway, back to AA. And Cher and I got together, and we met, and eventually came to be married. Now, we were both smokers, and one night on the internet, Cher was just noodling around, and she showed up. She showed me the Vonna Room, Voices of Nicotine Recovery. And I looked at it again, very half-heartedly, and I said, eh, maybe, maybe not. And I let it go. Cher wanted to quit, but I wasn't at this point in time where I wanted to try stopping. That was about, I would say, 2005. And so life went on. I got a few years of sobriety, or was getting a few years of sobriety under my belt. And I was starting to feel a lot better in that respect, but my smoking continued to spiral out of control. Quitting, smoking, quitting, stopping, quitting, and so on and so forth. Got less financially stable due to the smoking, less, my physical health was in the tank. I started showing up with the first signs of emphysema. And ironically, I was working at the local hospital, and I used to see these people every day. Tracheotomies, having their larynx removed, hooked to oxygen tanks, and emphysema, people being wheeled out and wheeled to the morgue. And what did that person die of? Well, he was a smoker. Oh, okay. Want to go have a cigarette? Sure. Anyway, continued to work at the hospital for a few years, and had to go on disability due to a back injury. A few years later, Cher showed me the Voices of Nicotine Recovery Room. And I was smoking now more because of the pain that I was having, the injury, my back pain, and I was smoking a lot. And I do mean a lot. Doing 3 packs a day. And there was lots of more stopping and starting. There was burning holes in my clothes, burning holes. Now I had graduated to smoking in bed in front of the TV set. And it just kept going and going and going, and eventually Sharon reintroduced me to Voices of Nicotine Recovery again, yet a second time. And I thought this time, well, this looks like something I could possibly deal with. And I think it had a lot to do with the fact that I had been introduced and had a good grasp on the 12 steps in the other program now. That's why that I was more receptive to it. I had started a lot of quits in Bonner. I do mean a lot. And never once was I berated or said, well, you failed, Dan. Never once. I was welcomed with open arms every time I came back, just like in the other program. And people would tell me to keep coming back. And I thought, well, this is great. This is just like the other program, and Meeting Makers Make It was definitely my motto. It became my motto. It started working the steps and did the steps one by one, and it really started to all come together, and I got a great sponsor. And it started to come together that it did not have to be an all-or-nothing proposition. It did not have to be forever. It did not have to be eternity. And am I still on?
Hi.
Okay. I see it. Anyway, it didn't have to be an all or nothing proposition, or did not have to be hang on a second. We had a phone call. Anyway, I've slowly learned that it was possible, just like in the other program, to take it one day at a time, or 1 hour at a time, or 1 minute at a time, if I had to. And I am I would like to talk to you now just for a couple of minutes about my higher power. I was raised in a certain religion where it was pretty much forced on me, you know, made to go to church, made to go to Sunday school, made to go to services daily, and because of that, when I got older, I got as far away from the church as possible. I ran like hell, let me tell you. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. But when I was introduced to the concept or the premise of a higher power, and I thought that was a pretty good deal. I was satisfied with the fact that I could make it the higher power of my own making. Not a vengeful, spiteful, punishing God, but a loving, kind, caring, compassionate God. And that's the God I believe in today. And that is my also, I believe in God in Jesus, okay? And we'll just leave that at that. And that's where I'm at. I absolutely devoured the long version of the Serenity Prayer. It helped me through so many times, so many rough nights, so many long nights, and I do pray and meditate daily. I don't like to talk about service work, but because it sounds like I'm tooting my own horn, but I did immerse myself into service work, probably a little bit too much, maybe. But again, it's all relative. I don't know what is a lot to one person in that respect is just mediocre to someone else's viewpoint. Anyway, I got immersed myself in service work, and service work absolutely positively saved me. I would not have had this quit had I not been doing service work, chairing meetings. It doesn't matter what it has to be. It doesn't matter what it is. Reading the steps, greeting, topic keeping. Well, I suck at that, but everybody knows that. Anyway, I am closer to you. I've said this before, and I hope this does not cheapen the sentiment, but I am closer to some of you, to most of you, than I am my own immediate family. And I do love you with all my heart, and I thank you for saving my life. I still take a daily inventory, so I do my best to take a daily inventory, and I try and practice my principles before personalities. I'm running out of stuff to say, folks. I just want to say that one more thing, and that is because of the 12 steps, I can live a good, productive, meaningful life. And I thought you were going to sing. I'm going to break into song? No. Paula would red dot me. Anyway, this isn't much of a finish, but thank you so much again for giving me back my life. Thank you so much for saving my life and for being here for me, continuing to be here for me. And just a big thank you to all. I love you very much. Thank you, and go ahead.